Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Think wine and food, and a lot of folks think fundraiser. Combining wine and food have become staples for the philanthropy set. Why? Well, for one thing, it's easy to get people to eat, and the other element makes it, shall we say, easier to give. Just consider how many of these events there are in these parts. Village West has its wine walk and food. Harvesters has its forks and corks. The Independent Square Association has sip and shop, art and wine walk. You get the idea. Today, a look at why wine and food continues to be a fundraising staple. With us today, Doug Frost. He's holder of the dual titles of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. And Doug, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be back.
Ted Habiger is also back. He's a owner and chef of the Room 39 restaurants. Ted, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
And also with us today is Dina Morrison. She's special events manager for the Community Services League. That's a nonprofit organization located in Independence that works to lift people to economic stability. And Dina, nice to have you here too.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, before we talk a whole lot, Doug, you've brought some vino here with you, and you've got white, you've got red, you're pouring the white, and tell us about it.
Well, we're just having a little Robert Mondavi Fumé Blanc, one of the progenitors of the style. In fact, the guy who literally coined the term Fumé Blanc, because there was Sauvignon Blanc being grown and made into kind of an insipid white wine with a little touch of sugar back in the 60s. And when he came back from France on his first fact-finding trip in the early 60s, he wanted to make a different style of Sauvignon Blanc, drier, fuller-bodied, maybe even a touch of, you know, time in barrel. And so he took his cue, really, in the term from a grape called Sauvignon Blanc. But in the Loire Valley, places called Sancerre and Puy-Fumé, it was actually called Blanc Fumé, because when it ripens, it turns kind of smoky, hence the term Fumé. So he flipped the term and called it Fumé Blanc, and now that's what we often call the grape.
Ted, this is a dry wine for sure.
Have you
sipped some?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite grapes because it goes so well with food.
The
acidity in it, you know, you've got good citrus notes a lot of the time. You got some herbal notes, you know, and this particular one seems like it's kind of on that herbaceous side.
I always love how wine people use words like notes, like dry note, whatever you're saying, notes of this. This sounds like you know what you're talking about. I need to start incorporating that into my own parlance here a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like it's a little bit of BS sometimes, doesn't it? You know,
but there is a little bit. Dude,
cool,
you're going to run me out of a job here in a second.
It sounds cool.
But, there is a lexicon of words that you use, and everybody in the business kind of... I personally don't like the ones that are too much about, like, chocolate notes and everything. I like ones that more describe style a lot of the times, so, you know, masculine, feminine, heavy.
Yeah, but I always get worked up about that one, too. Like, what is masculine? Yeah. What is feminine?
That's
I mean,
true.
You know, it really
true.
Opens up a box of gender, you know, silliness. But nonetheless, I mean, you bring up the point that we're trying to give people an idea of what it's going to talk like,
right.
What it's going to taste like. And you're trying to come up with words that mean something. And at least we have some sense of what,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, we do know what, I guess, lemon tastes
yeah,
like,
but,
you know.
But, you know, masculine, like. Feminine, those words do have at least a, you know, cliche sort of sense. So it's part of the problem of describing something as ambiguous and as personal and, most importantly, as subjective as flavor.
Yeah. Well, speaking of subjectivity here, Allison Rallitz from our community engagement team is sitting here with us, and you've just tasted this. And give us your own expert view of what you just tasted here.
Well, Steve, I'd like to admit and / confess I had a bite of a cinnamon roll right before I came in here. And I would like to say this actually surprisingly goes a little nice with a little cinnamon roll in
nice.
It.
Nice.
You know, like it's like kind of a drier taste. And when you the combination of the flavors together is quite lovely, actually.
Mm-hmm. Dina, have you tasted here yet? Have you had a sip?
Yeah, I have. It's quite delicious.
It's working for you.
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
It helps.
Chris.
It helps the conversation get flowing here. Well, let's turn to our main topic here today, this notion of wine and food that pairing as such a common staple for fundraisers. Why are these events just so popular, Dina? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think a good part of it is that it's like a party.
Mm-hmm.
You're not stuck at a table. You're able to mingle around. You're tasting tastes that you a little bit here, a little bit there, things you might not otherwise have an opportunity to taste. We try to bring in vendors that are new to the area, presenting some new taste to people, and they're drinking wine and drinking other libations, and that, you know, contributes to the party atmosphere.
I think it's so
such a good point, though. People aren't stuck in one place. They're moving around.
Right.
They're tasting different things, and that makes for a little looser environment, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Doug, you host a number of these events. What's your sense of why these two ideas go so well together, or do I even have to ask?
Yeah. Well, no, I do think that one of the things about wine is it's you know, there's so many kinds of wine, so many different wines out there that people are always looking for some guidance. And so, you know, when you go to an event and there's one white, one red, it's not very interesting. And when you go to an event and there's 20 whites or 40 whites and, you know, 40 reds, it becomes very interesting all of a sudden for people because now they can try different stuff and say, well, what did you like? Well, what did you like? And they're really seeking to learn something about this, even though they're really just in an entertainment setting. And then finally, as Dina and I were laughing about earlier, it's like, yeah, you know, well, if you're trying to have an auction too, there is really no better assistance for an auctioneer than making sure that everybody's had a few glasses of wine.
Yeah. Yeah. Ted, you've noticed the same phenomenon here, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we do quite a few events a year, and I've always noticed that you know, if you can get a glass of alcohol in somebody's hands and it loosens up the wallets a little bit,
yeah.
And, you know, and usually it's a good way to raise money.
You know, I still can't get over the fact, Doug, and we've talked about this so many times when you've been in here, but, you know, your services at an event like this, you're explaining the product, the wine and what it is and how it's made and why it tastes the way it tastes. And that's all because this industry, the wine industry, continues. It remains under this shroud of mystery and in a way that you've sort of rebelled against over the years. And I still puzzle over myself. Why is it changing?
I think it is. I really do feel like my daughter's generation has a completely different attitude about wine. And I think it's
In what way?
Well, in the sense that wine to them is not as opaque as it is as it was to us. I would really say that everything, you know, when you've got a computer in your hand at all times, everything is transparent on some level. Yeah, you can immediately look stuff up. You can tweet it out to your buddies and see what they think about it. You can drop it on all sorts of apps and have people comment upon whether, you know, that's a good vintage or a bad vintage. So there's so much information out now that people feel less intimidated by it. And I would also say that, you know, sort of the converse to that, which is that there's so much information out now that people already get that there's too much information. Nobody gets to own it all. I'm not surprised that there's a category like wine that's overwhelming to me. That's every category out there. So I'm no longer going to view wine as some kind of weird and wondrous thing aside from everything else. Everything is incredibly, you know, myriad and complicated if you really want to go down the rabbit hole.
Ted, you sense the same thing at Room 39? Are your consumers, are they as inquisitive? Or are they more knowledgeable these days as they come in to your restaurants? Or what are you seeing?
Well, it's a good question because you bring up the thing about the iPhone or your Android phone or whatever. And every single time that I put something on the list, I realize that they could easily just punch it into their phone right there and see what the retail price is, you know, compare it to what my pricing is. They can look at the vintage, decide whether or not that's the vintage that they want. And the consumer's gotten a lot smarter, I guess, in a way,
wow,
through the technology. But at the same time, they still need, you know, it's still one of those things. Like, you don't know what it's going to taste like exactly until you open up the bottle. And that's where we come in as servers and restaurant owners, because we've tasted most of the bottles on our list.
Yeah.
And get to guide people through their experience.
You know, Dina Morrison with the Community Services League, I gather that, as you mentioned, some fresh taste, some new taste to folks who attend a wine and cheese fundraiser, a wine and food fundraiser of some kind. How important is that? Different stuff, new stuff.
Oh, it's very important because we're having a lot of our core supporters come back year after year. So we want to offer them something new and different to make them interested in coming. We always have some of our great stalwarts that are there every year and provide kind of the basic food for us that's always awesome.
And those stalwarts are things like what?
The Herford House, Zarda Barbecue out of Blue Springs. We have had Cooper's Hawk now for a couple of years.
Yeah, people want that kind of foundation for an event like this. Yeah.
But we've also had some new tastes out of the Independence Innovation Center. They have
what is that?
Well, it's like a incubator type of organization that helps small businesses get off the ground. And we've had soup glacé with, you know, cold soups, and we've had Spicy Guys pretzels and some new caterers out of there. And so it's some new and different tastes. Olive oils, different, you know, things that people are interested in trying.
Doug Frost, you would say the key to things that the importance of things being new and fresh would be what, at least in your mind?
Well, I think I'm actually reminded of the great Marshall McLuhan line that, you know, anyone who thinks there's a difference between education and entertainment doesn't understand either one. That, you know, as human beings, we're always looking for more information, but we'd like it to be packaged in such a way that it's really fun because really we're inquisitive creatures. And if you don't provide people with some sort of new and slightly different take on things, then why should they show up? I mean, I really do believe that innately we are inquisitive creatures. And so we want to know about stuff that we don't know about yet. And if you can make that fun while that happens, well, now, you know, now I actually want to be there and stay there.
An example of something fun would be what?
Well, I think wine tastings are pretty
fun. I mean, generally, but what kind of wine?
Sorry, I'm teasing. But, of course, I think that any chance that you get to see a wine that you've never had before and taste it for the first time when, you know, it generally has been out of your price range or you've decided that it, you don't want it to be in your price range.
And you're explaining what it is to boot.
Yeah, exactly. Helps. And you've got somebody there who can say, well, look, this is how it was made, and this is why we make it this way, and this is what it compares to, and this is what it might go with. And, you know, Ted's next door making some food, and people can go, oh, really? You should think I should try it with that? Yeah, you should go try it with that. That all of a sudden, that is a really not just, a, you know, a moment of sustenance, but it's now fun. It's interesting. Somebody's posed a challenge, and best of all, that there's really no right or wrong answer. So, it, you know, we like to eat and drink, and we like to do those together. And then the idea that somehow there's a perfect match for all that, which I think is always kind of silly, but nonetheless, each of us personally can have that moment where we find some wonderful match. Well, that's it's like it becomes like a big game to wander around the room and taste things.
Let me get our listeners involved here. What do you think makes for a good food and wine pairing? A good, what are the elements for a good charitable fundraiser? And do you agree with using food and wine to raise money for charity? Tell us about your experiences at one of these events. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, that's 816-235-2888. And Ted, you brought some food. Speaking of food, you brought some with you.
Yeah.
What
is
it?
You know, because we're talking about all these events, and one of the things that we try to do at the restaurant is make an impression whenever we do one of these things. I was taught a long time ago by Steve Cole at Cafe Allegro that when you do an event, you have to it has to stick in people's minds. One time we did ostrich for a Forks and Corks event down in the city market, and Steve actually got the farmer to bring up an ostrich and put it in a pen behind the food station. It was a little gruesome, I thought, but at the same time—
Was he the one, the ostrich that was sacrificed for the meal?
Well, no. We didn't do it in front of everybody, of course, but it was one of those moments where we
that
were—
That would be a moment.
No one would ever forget that. But, you know, you do, like, we try to premiere things, you know, like different dishes that we've been working on, something that's going to kind of, you know, get people to try something that maybe they've never tried before. And so, you know, we do things like that. Like, we did for Forks and Corks for we did the VIP room, and we did salt cod brandade fritters. So we were actually frying on site. And that's the other thing, is we try to do things on site where it's nice and hot and fresh and everything. And go from there.
Makes a big difference.
It really does.
Yeah. What kind of attention did the ostrich get that day?
Quite a bit. Yeah. I mean, I that was before I was working there, and it was one of those things. Like, I saw that, and I was like, I got to go work for this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really pushing the limits there.
Well, just listen to some of these wine, food, charitable events in the area here. The list is so long. Village West, Wine Walk and Food, Harvesters, Forks and Corks, the Independent Square Association's Sip and Shop, Art and Wine Walk, the Bonner Animal Rescue's Whiskers, Wages and Wine, Art Gala, Traveling Wine Tasting Trolley Party, benefiting the Alzheimer's Association. The list, you know, Dina, just sort of goes on and on and on here. You know, everyone's doing it.
Yes, they are. I mean, it's very popular. And again, I think it's because it's such a casual, relaxed atmosphere.
Yeah.
People can go and come and go as they will. which I think is a big draw there, too.
Yeah. What makes for a successful wine and food event? That's the question on the table here. 816-235-2888. You know, there are events ranging from the Community Services League's O event that Dina organizes at $75 a ticket to the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, the two-day multi-event shuttlecork currently ongoing, where the lowest priced event is $250, going all the way to a benefactor status for up to $50,000. Ted, what can one expect in the quality of food offered at these two very different events here?
Yeah, you know, for you have to make an impression no matter what. And so that first event, you know, doing something like that, you're going to do probably one item, and you're going to do it, you know, you might do a pork dish or something like that, but you got to make it interesting. Mm-hmm. And then for instance, for shuttlecore,
one key thing.
Yeah. Usually. And then for the shuttlecore event, like we did a dinner last night at the Helzbergs, and there was a lot of pressure
at the home.
Yeah. At their home. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've got 30 people that are spending a lot of money to do all these events, and the winemakers are there. And so you've got people from California that are judging you. You've got people that have donated money that are judging you, and you know, you lose a lot of sleep about it, but at the end you got to produce a really terrific meal.
Do you lose sleep about it still?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I woke up in a panic on Wednesday because I felt like I hadn't crossed all my T's yet, you know, and I was wondering about silverware, and I had to track Shirley. Shirley Helzberg is wonderful, and she was terrific to work with on this whole event, and I called her, and I didn't know if I would get her right away, you know, but I did. She picked up the phone immediately, and we both kind of assuaged our fears, and everything was fine. I could sleep after that.
And so the pressure is because, again, few people, a small crowd, and they're paying top dollar, right?
Yeah, and you're going off-site. You're going out of your comfort zone. You know, you're going to somebody else's home to cook where, you know, like last night we had a situation where we're at their house, and we're kind of searching for BTUs everywhere because we're cooking, you know, and we need heat. And a lot of home kitchens are not set up like restaurant kitchens. And I found my biggest BTUs out by their pool, by their grill. So their grill was hot and had good charcoal. I mean, I was able to, so I cooked everything in pans out on their grill.
Yeah. Doug, do you sense the same kind of pressure when you have an audience that's paying, you know, up to $50,000 in some cases to benefit one group or another?
I'm not sure I've slept in 2 days, to be quite honest with you.
Seriously.
Yeah, we did 6 dinners last night. Ted's was one of them, and had 12 winemakers fly in from, you know, various places to attend to at each of these dinners. And I was the guy responsible for all the wine and the winemakers and the glassware. And, yeah, it's pretty much you ask yourself constantly, why am I doing this again? Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you remember this is an opportunity that you can give back in some way. And I felt like I could bring in some cool and interesting people. And somebody like Ted is willing to donate his time and money. And somebody like Shirley Helzberg is willing to open her home up, which the home is completely, you know, wonderfully crazy, incredible. So it becomes this something that clearly stirs a lot of people to go, okay, you know, I do know already donate money to the museum, but maybe I'll up the ante this time just because this is something special and different. But as Dina was saying, you know, the question will arise, what are we going to do next year?
Yeah. The home is crazy. Why?
Oh, my God. It's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful homes in America. It's situated up on top of the hill. Many people, I think, know the home. And inside, it's the woodwork is insane and gorgeous. And, of course, it's filled with amazing artifacts. And we sat in this huge, long room that feeds out onto where the pool is and where the grill is. And while it was we weren't sure what the weather was going to be like, you can open it up and it's still beautiful outside. So it's just it's an amazing place with the most, you know, the craziest antiques I've seen in a long time that Shirley has collected over the years, Shirley and Barnett.
And I'm just curious, you flew in who for an event like this? And how did you explain what the event was a little bit more to us?
Sure, of course. Well, for Ted's dinner, we had Jim Clendenin in from Oboe and Clément.
One of my heroes, by the way.
And
it was fantastic.
From where?
Oboe and Clément is one of the pioneers of South Central Coast viticulture, or Central Coast to some degree, viticulture in California. and the other winemaker, or I should say the other gentleman, was Paul Leary, a Blackbird, who runs Blackbird up in Napa, which is a very nice, you know, very, very good, I think, Napa Red sort of producer. Jim is one of my heroes as well. Truthfully, for me, in my early career, I met Jim back in the mid-'80s, and it was, you know, for me, it was a seminal moment. I spent about 3 hours tasting with him one day in the late 80s in his cellar, and I've been to thousands of such, and that's one of those top 10 experiences of my life.
Because
and so he has so much to teach about Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and winemaking and wine tasting and how wines age and how wines evolve. And you know, it's just – I just wandered around after him and soaked up everything I could. And he makes really stellar – one of the great Pinot Noirs of the world, no question about it, and one of the great Chardonnays of the world. We had a 97 Chardonnay last night, which is 17 years old and was gorgeous and delicious. Mm. And that's hard to do. 17-year-old Chardonnay is tough to make right.
Again, some listeners might be trying to hang on to this, but this is one fundraising event for the Nelson Atkins, right?
Yes.
And you're flying in masters of wine from all over the country.
Well, winemakers. We had a master of wine in. We had two different master sommeliers in.
They're flying in just for this event.
I say three different master sommeliers. I'm sorry, I should correct myself. Yeah, but just for this event, Greg Harrington of Gramercy Cellars in Washington and Drew Hendricks of Rudd in Napa and Joe Spellman of Justin Winery in Paso Robles.
And once they're at the event, they do what, Doug? What's the deal?
Again, the issue is they teach people about these wines. They interact with people and show them what they can about the wines in front of them and about, you know, the bigger elements as well. And I think for a lot of people, it's always fun to discover wine is made by people. It's not a factory product. That it's, in general, it needs to be an artisanal product, even in a large scale. I mean, people look at somebody like Robert Mondavi Winery and see this very large scale winery, but it each individual wine still has to be made by a person. And typically, you do scale down to one person making this Fumé Blanc, and that's all they do. So it's the artisanal product of one person, even if it's, you know, the winery itself has 30 such people.
Yeah. And Dina, when you do the O event for the Community Services League, how does that contrast and compare to what we're talking about here? It's a different – we're talking a different deal, right?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. We're on a completely different level of that. But likewise, you know, we offer the opportunity to educate people, and they're very interested in learning what they can from the Missouri wineries that we have represented there in large part. Most of our vendors that are serving wine there in O are Missouri wineries.
Yeah.
And then we also have a premium area where we partner with a local liquor store. I say that, a local a wine store.
Yeah.
And she does some educating in her area of some more national and international wines.
Yeah.
So we do offer that. And we have an event prior to O that is a VIP event, and it's limited attendance. Only about 75 spots are available.
Mm.
And every year we try to do something different. We had a barrel tasting last year from Amigoni locally. And then
barrel tasting, you're talking about wine.
Yes,
here, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then this year we had a representative from Riedel come in and do a tasting with their Venom XL wine glasses, and had four different varieties of wines, and just sort of educating people on how the difference in a glass can affect the taste. And so it was really, it was very interesting.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. Before we go, Ted, just you brought some food with you. Tell us again what you've got there, and we'll sort of maybe taste during the break and talk about it when we come back here.
You bet. This is a lamb loin that's cured in a merguez style, with a little bit of prairie tome cheese from Green Dirt Farm, some sorrel, and some radish from Crumb Heirlooms.
Well, it looks absolutely lovely.
Thank you.
Let's taste some right now. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here about food and wine fundraisers, and we'll take your questions, 816-235-2888. Perhaps you want a recommendation for what might work at your fundraiser. Again, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation about navigating without GPS, or you're looking for our weekend to-do list, you can find those at kcur.org. Monday on the program, psychologist Wes Crenshaw is back, and he'll bring a panel of ADD and ADHD patients to discuss how to get good diagnosis and treatment right from the start. That's Monday's show. This hour, we're talking about wine and food fundraisers. We're visiting with Doug Frost. He's a holder of the dual titles of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. Ted Hebiger is here. He's owner and the chef of the Room 39 restaurants. And Dina Morrison is a special events manager for the Community Services League. That's a nonprofit organization located in Independence. Our number here, 816-235-2888. And Allison, you just had a little taste of what Ted had to bring us here. And what did you think?
Well, first off, I was really excited because I haven't been out to a Green Dirt Farm, so that was my first tasting from there.
There you go.
And it was really nice. It was pretty savory and not nearly as salty as I thought it was going to be. So good. Good one. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dina, what did you think?
Oh, yeah. It was delicious.
Worked okay. It. Doug? Yeah.
Well, last night I didn't get to try it, but it was matched up with a rosé. And that was really fun, too. It was a dry rosé, and I think dry rosé is very much a coming category. And so it was fun to sort of throw into the middle of this very serious dinner with all these very serious wines. Let's have some pink wine, you know?
Yeah.
And I think everybody loved it.
And dry rosé is a coming attraction because why?
Well, I think that the whole phenomenon of white Zinfandel has tailed off. Now, once upon a time, white Zinfandel was the most popular,
yes,
you know, single wine in the U.S.
Always
market.
Always a hit in this room when you bring some, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, if it had a knock or if there was a reason that there was a sort of backlash against it over the last 5 or 10 years, it's been that, well, you know, it's a sweet wine and I don't like sweet wines, which I never get that because I like sweet wines. I like dry wines. I like all wines. My daughter, who's actually going to be pouring tonight at the Nelson at King Estate, was going on that diatribe in the paper last week about how people will badmouth sweet wine when really they would probably like it if they just tasted the darn thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened, though, I think as sweet as pink wines have become increasingly drier, they've opened up been embraced by more people. I think it's simply that a wine, simply because it's pink, does not need to be sweet. It does not need to be dry. It doesn't need to be anything any more than any other wine needs to be sweet, dry, or otherwise. So we're just seeing now more choices when it comes to rosés or pink wines.
Yeah. Ted, we were talking in our first half about the dinner that you threw last night at the Helzbergs. You know, how did you get a gig like that? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, Doug asked me to do it, first of all,
mm-hmm,
which is a great honor because, you know, there were six of us that were chosen to do it last night. And, you know, and every year it changes probably a little bit, you know, so you never know if you get to do it the next year or something.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, it's one of those things like you get asked and then the pressure's on, you know, and you have to produce and go to a few meetings along the way. And there's a lot of people involved, you know, I think we had 3 people pouring wine last night, plus 3 servers, plus my sous chef was there. And, you know, it's a production.
So it's a big deal for a small business like yours to take part in.
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, you know, it's one of those opportunities that, you know, we kind of treat each event like this that, you know, we're not necessarily, you know, it's not one of our for-profit moments, but it's our advertising. You know, it's, mm-hmm, we don't do, you know, a lot of other traditional advertising. For us, it's about getting our food in front of people, telling our story. You know, and I get an opportunity at these sorts of dinners to get up and tell people exactly how everything's being cooked. And, you know, and sometimes before the evening starts, I'm like, oh, are they going to want to listen to me? I have to interrupt them, you know. Is this going to be okay? And then right away, people are engaged, and they want to know about everything. They want to know where the food came from. They want to know how you prepared it, how long you've been working on it, you know.
I was going to say, how long did you work on this particular dinner? Doug first invited you when, and
right,
how much time did you put into it?
Yeah, I think he first mentioned it to me probably last September or October, and then we started meeting about him in January. And
no kidding.
Yeah,
and you're talking about what?
Well, you know, about getting over to the site and visiting the house, and so you can kind of get the lay of the land.
What the kitchen facilities are like and what you have at your,
What kind of rentals we need, that sort of stuff. And so we start that process, which, Incidentally, that's the meeting where I didn't take very good notes. I was so impressed with the house and with Shirley that I was kind of – I went back and looked at my notes, and I'm like, I didn't write much down. Uh-oh.
Wow.
And that caused me to lose my sleep. But then but then something really interesting happened last night where I get a lot of emails during the day, and a lot of the time I'm in my kitchen, and so I'm not looking at my computer. And I missed an email from Doug at one point asking for a menu because Jim Clendenden needed the menu. He's from Avant Clément, the winery. He needed the menu, and so he could determine what wines he was going to send. I missed that entirely. And Doug kind of stuck up for me with Jim and said, no, we'll get you the menu. And Jim, like last night, he said that he has never, like in 1,000 of these events that he's done, he's stuck to his plan, 999 times. And he was very skeptical coming in that I had done this menu after I'd gotten the wines from him. And I think he was very happy. In my defense, I said, Jim, this isn't California. This is Missouri. We don't know what we're going to have yet, Mm-hmm. I got spinach, I got asparagus, I got radishes all within hours of arriving at the Helzberg house. Mm-hmm. I mean, the farmers all brought it that day. Mm-hmm. And the menu was planned, but you still never know exactly what you're going to have.
In terms of fresh produce, obviously, yeah. This is a more challenging time of year, too.
Yeah, it's really opening up right now. So it's challenging, but it's also really fun. Mm-hmm. It's so much better than beginning of March, or late February.
And because
you have asparagus and ramps and morel mushrooms. Yeah. We had morel mushrooms on the dinner last night.
Oh, they were so good. I love morels so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, can I ask, do you guys get paid for these? These are charitable events. Do you get paid?
Yeah. Not really. I mean, they take care of some expenses, but, it's not like what we'd be charging in the restaurant for sure.
You're more or less contributing your time to a good cause here. That's
absolutely
sort of what this is all about. Yeah. Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about food and wine and fundraisers and how all those combinations, how that combination works so well together. 816-235-2888. If you have a question for our good panel here, Dina, I was wondering, you've had the dubious honor of planning and organizing and setting up one of these things. How long does it take you to pull all the various, the wineries and the food establishments together? How much time goes into something like that on your end of things?
Oh, you can imagine hours. We have community volunteers who serve on a variety of committees that help us do the planning, and we get started really right after the event ends in the spring. It's late April or early May. Setting the date for the next year, starting to get the word out. But really the strong committee work gets started in the fall, and really goes gangbusters at the first of the year, getting us ready for the event.
How stressful is an event like this?
Well, it's pretty stressful. We're wanting to present a great event, and it's an opportunity for us to also present what we do and maybe gain some new supporters of Community Services League. So it's there's a lot riding on it.
And I suppose if things go wrong, if the food ain't right, then I think the fundraising suffers as a result.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, people will not want to come back the next year if something major goes wrong. It's a reputation kind of thing. So we very much want them to have a wonderful experience, to learn about what we do, to see their friends, to just make it an event that they want on their calendar every year.
Doug, you're nodding your head when Dina was talking. I'm just guessing here, maybe you've been to an event or two, or maybe the vibe wasn't quite right for one reason or another.
It's just that as soon as you're successful, no good deed goes unpunished. So as soon as you're successful, as Dina said, you're immediately planning for the next year's event. And charities learn to rely upon it. So some of the charities that I deal with, like Angel Flight Central, they have learned to rely upon an event that we do called Wine Flight that's in the fall. And tomorrow night I help with a fundraiser for Friends of Chamber Music. And if that doesn't go well, then the organization actually suffers because they've now learned to rely upon this income in order to do their business. So you begin to feel a great deal of stress because you realize that you can't do the same thing and expect the same results, frankly. You have to constantly rethink it. And is that going to be a better result or a worse result? You've got to figure out, how to keep costs lowered, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, for a master of wine and a master sommelier, just hearing you talk, Doug, how crowded is your calendar every year from events like the ones we're talking about here?
Well, my calendar is always crowded, so I try to do maybe six, maybe 10 charity events a year, and try to choose them carefully. But you know, whereas once upon a time I had dreamed that I could say yes to everything, I've had to learn. You know, I did worked with Community Services League at one point, and I've had to learn to recognize that certain charities have now really relied upon me to help them with this. So I have to make choices and mm-hmm. focus upon those.
So you do six or eight or ten a year, and you could do, if you took every single several dozen.
Well, yeah, it can always – it's funny. When people want to do a party, they're probably going to need food. So Ted probably gets asked every other day. Indeed, a couple of restaurants, I was just thinking about that I called to check in on various issues, actually have a separate, you know, number that you push if you'd like to ask for a donation. I mean, that's how often restaurants are getting hit up and wineries get hit up constantly. And you know, if you're going to have a party, you're going to need something to eat and something to drink. So, we all could be busy every single day of the year.
Bottom line, Ted, how big of a difference does it make when you get this kind of exposure to this kind of audience? Do you see it in the restaurant, in the crowd you get weeks to come?
I mean, it's definitely hard to measure. You know, it's not like if you get reviewed in the paper or something like that, you immediately will see, you know, an influx 30% or something like that.
Really?
More people.
Yeah.
But it is about building your brand and about, you know, giving back to the community and continuing to put yourself in a good light and keeping and being relevant. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, our restaurant is going to celebrate our 10th anniversary this year, and we're not the new guys on the block. We're not the one that people are like, oh, I got to go try room 39. Mm-hmm. We have to continue to push our envelope and make sure that we're doing stuff that are new and exciting and keep those customers.
Doug, you're pouring a new glass. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, it's Pinot Noir time. Pinot Noir is a favorite grape of mine, certainly. And this is King Estate out of Oregon. I've always been a nut for Oregon Pinot Noir. One of the winemakers that we had in town is David Adelsheim, who's one of the real great pioneers of Oregon Pinot Noir. And he reminded me last night that I was I was one of his early customers outside of Oregon, which I didn't remember going all the way back to the mid-80s as a wholesaler. And, you know, it was kind of fun to remember. In fact, that's where I first met Jim Clendenin of Obon Clément, was in Oregon, because he was an early, as a California winemaker, he was an early proponent of what was happening in Oregon as well, all the way back into the 80s. So this grape just needs cooler spots. Oregon has a lot of those. California has plenty of those as well. It's a grape that doesn't need a lot of heat. So Pinot Noir grown, you know, in Missouri would be difficult. You know, we have our own grapes for that, Norton and things like that.
Yeah. Dina, the O fundraiser also has the added incentive of an auction at your event. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's quite a large part of the event. Mm-hmm. We end up securing at least 40 to 45% of our gross revenue from the auction.
No kidding.
And it's we have a large silent auction. I think we had over 180 packages, and we completely rely on the generosity of people in our community to donate things, local businesses, mm-hmm. individuals. We have art. We have dining experiences. We try to get things that you know, that appeal to a broad range of pocketbooks, if you will. And then also some experiences that you just cannot go out and buy. For example,
Important at an event like this,
it
right?
It really is. Mm-hmm. You know, people, if they can, they're going to price compare if they think they can go and get it, you know, or it's not as cool to them if they can, you know, just go out and have the same experience. For example, we were able to secure some time over at Legoland with the master builder. And it's not something that, you know,
cool.
Yeah, it sounds
I'll
like something
right
for
now.
Kids,
yeah.
But we had, we had some adults who are just never too old for Legos. And it was quite a successful item. And exciting for us because it's definitely not something you can just go and
How many items do you have to come up with to make this auction work for you guys? How many items are you talking about?
Well, we had, like I said, we had over 180 packages, and that really represents probably in excess of 300 individual auction items. Some of the things that we might pair a restaurant gift certificate with some Royals tickets, or, you know, we kind of try to do an evening out or a daytime trip for a family, that kind of stuff.
So this is one event on one night, and I'm wondering, what percentage of your budget is derived from this one event on one night?
It's not a huge percentage of our budget, but what the most important thing to us is that it's unrestricted dollars. A lot of what we do, we're trying to help the neediest people in our community.
And you get some government support, I gather.
Government support. And that support is a lot of grants. We operate off of different foundation grants.
And that money has to be used in certain ways. And you're saying
it's
the auction
specific,
and the
yes.
fundraising dollars gives you a little more freedom and flexibility.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just like any other business, not-for-profit, we have overhead costs. We have, salaries that, just aren't always covered by grant or foundation funding. And so this gives us the ability to use those dollars where we need it and where we see fit.
Doug Frost, I gather in some of the ones that you've done over the years, would it be unusual to have an event on one night account for, 10, 15, 20% of the annual budget of an organization?
Not at all. Not for smaller organizations.
That's why there's so much pressure on these things.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a big deal. And as Dina says, you try to come up with some auction items that are interesting. That one, Legoland, sounds very cool. Tonight, one of the Nelson lots that's being auctioned off is a trip to New York to go visit important museums like the Museum of Modern Art with Julian Zugasa-Goicia, the director of the Nelson.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Julian, who knows all these folks, can walk you to certain paintings.
So he's going with you on this
thing? He
goes
with you. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have to have something like that in order to really inspire people to think, well, I want to be there. And even if I'm not going to bid on that, I'm going to show up. And then, of course, you hope that the idea is hatched in their head of maybe I'll arrive ready to bid next year, or maybe I'll just go hit the silent auction and buy a little something, and a little something turns into two or three little somethings, and there you go. It's just human nature to start to play and start to become acquisitive, as long as we're trying to make you think about being inquisitive as well.
And Ted, you said you'll do how many of these kind of events during the course of a year?
Yeah, we do quite a few just donations to auctions, and then we probably do about 40 of those a year, and then we do an additional maybe 15, about one a month, mm-hmm. Where we show up and actually do live cooking or do an event like we did last night.
Yeah. And Dean, I gather one a year for you is probably plenty.
Of this type of event,
yeah.
Yes. We have a number of other things, of course, that we do, but this particular event has a lot of moving parts.
Yeah. I want to thank our guests here for coming in today and talking about all this. Doug Frost, holder of the dual titles of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. Doug, it's always great to have you here.
Well, thank you so much, Dean.
Ted Habiger from Room 39. Ted, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Dina Morrison from the Community Services League. So good to have you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.